Welcome to Unpacking Peanuts, the podcast where three cartoonists take an in-depth look at the greatest comic strip of all time, Peanuts by Charles M. Schulz.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. This is Unpacking Peanuts, where we discuss the life and work of Charles Schulz and the greatest comic strip of all time, Peanuts. How are you people doing out there? You doing well? I hope you are. If not, I think we have something today that might turn things around for you. I'm Jimmy Gownley. I'm one of your hosts for this evening. I'm the cartoonist of Amelia Rules and Seven Good Reasons Not to Grow Up and The Dumbest Idea Ever. And joining me, as always, are my pals, co-hosts, and fellow cartoonists. First, he's a composer and a playwright. He's a composer both for the band Complicated People as well as for this very podcast. He is the co-creator of the original Comic Book Price Guide, the original editor for Amelia Rules, and the cartoonist behind Strange Attractors, A Gathering of Spells, and Tangled River, Michael Cohen.
Hey there.
And he's the writer and executive producer of Mystery Science Theater 3000, a former vice president of Archie Comics, and the current creator of the Instagram strip Sweetest Beasts, Harold Buchholz.
Hello.
And guys, it's a great day here on Unpacking Peanuts because we have a very special guest in the house. Benjamin Clark is with us. Benjamin is the curator of the Charles M. Schulz Museum, as well as the co-author, along with Nat Gertler, of the brand new book, Charles M. Schulz, The Art and Life of the Peanuts Creator in 100 Objects, which is a really fascinating, cool book that is curated artifacts from Schulz's home and his studio that gives a glimpse into his personal life, into his career. It just gives a context to the person that put together this fantastic work of art. It's a great book, and I'm really excited to get to talk to one of the authors today. So please welcome Benjamin Clark. Benjamin, thank you for coming on the show.
Oh my God, thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, it's a big thrill for me to have you on the show. I love the Schulz Museum. I got to be an artist in residence out there about 12 years ago now, and it's one of the highlights of my life. It's just an absolute magical place. So just to kind of get background on you for our listeners, you came to this whole career through what I understand, like a love of history, yeah. Right? That was what you said. So tell me, which came first? Was it the love of history or the love of Schulz?
Well, that's hard to nail down, you know, because I'm of an age where, you know, Peanuts was already Peanuts, you know, when I came into the world. So it was, right. You know, I have no memory of being introduced to Peanuts because it just was everywhere,
right.
And just completely ubiquitous. And I loved it from a very, very early age. I can remember my grandmother sending the you know, Charlie Brown encyclopedia sets when I was like a preschooler, you know, and just being fascinated and looking through those. And so, yeah, I mean, I loved Peanuts from time immemorial. and I can pinpoint my love of history, too. It was that was in the seventh grade when I fell in love with history and thought, okay, I think I know I have to have a job someday, and I
that's really, always a terrible realization.
It is a horrifying realization, but it's also like, okay, I need to strategize because I don't want to just do whatever. Like, I got to think this through,
right?
I don't want to wind up like I'm in school. You know, I got stuck here, and I'm just stuck here, and I hate it. It's like, okay, I got to figure something else out. So, I fell in love with history, and I was like, okay, how do I do history? Like, I don't want to be a teacher because, I mean, that's just back to school again. So it's like, how do I not do that but still do history? And so that was kind of the big question for several years until I kind of eventually figured out museum work and got into museums.
So you graduated from York University in 2002, and you have a BA in history and a minor in religious history. So do you have a focus that you thought you might kind of move through as you were moving into your master's degree in museum science? Or was it kind of disconnected from one another?
I wasn't super sure. I was just willing to kind of go wherever the jobs were. I knew that the jobs were hard to get, so I tried to stay flexible. I thought maybe I would wind up just, you know, working in you know, public history of some fashion in the Midwest where I grew up. So I kind of did some of that type of work for a while, and that was fine, you know, but no, I'm really, really loving where I'm at. So
that's wonderful.
And how did that come about? How did you first become involved with the Schultz people?
Gosh, it was a while ago. So over 5 years ago now, they help wanted, curator needed at the Schultz Museum, you know. And I saw it on one of the museum job post, you know, job boards, and I just thought, oh my God, what a dream job that would be. Oh yeah. Boy, some lucky person is just gonna have a wow, that's a sweet gig. And I was told my wife, and I said, boy, that would just really be great, wouldn't it? Can you imagine? Boy. Somebody out there is really going to be lucky. And she said, well, why not you? I said, well, there's like comic scholars, you know, are you kidding me? Like they're going to find some scholarly comic person, or even like a working cartoonist, even like somebody is going to, you know, get that job. And it's not going to be me. It's definitely not going to be me. And she said, well, just apply, you know? So they had a very, involved application process. Basically, I had to curate a whole exhibition.
Wow.
Just from like, they didn't send me a whole lot to work with either. So, and I think that was kind of part of the test.
Right, right.
And so, so I did that, and they told me they love my writing in particular. And so, that I could do historical, but still retain humor, you know, and not, mm-hmm. don't kill the humor, you know, because right. Writing about comics, especially in the capacity I need to in a gallery or something and explain what's going on to a visitor, it is challenging to not, you know, destroy the joke. And
well, the other thing I thought that was interesting that you bring that up is in some ways what you're doing with your writing mirrors actually what Schultz had to do, in that you're writing for a general audience and you're talking about some things that are pretty complex in some ways. Right. But, it might be a 7-year-old or it might be a 70-year-old.
Right.
It might be someone who has a PhD in the subject or someone who has no idea. How do you handle that? Because it's actually a rarity for people to have to reach that type of wide audience these days.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Yeah. No, it's just being able to write clearly and directly is usually just the best folk, you know, just the best goal to have. You'll reach most people, and even the person with the PhD, you know, they're going to still learn something along the way. Also, because I'm doing a lot of, you know, research, I'm constantly doing research and finding new things. So hopefully even the experts come and we'll learn and see something cool.
Oh, absolutely. Well, tell us just what your day is like, because I'm assuming you're planning some things out months, maybe years in advance, right? But yep. Then you're also doing things like this and, you know, and obviously you've written this book, which we're definitely going to talk about later. So tell running through a day for us, what would it be like working your job?
Sure. So yeah, you're right. We do plan, you know, our exhibition schedule is, you know, years in advance. And so sometimes doing like, you know, if somebody does want to do a podcast interview or the, you know, a newspaper somewhere picks it up or, and they want to talk about an exhibition that's currently on view, I sometimes have to like go back out to the galleries and go look at it, because it's been, you know, a year and a half since I've thought about it.
So, right.
So I'm constantly doing that. So like right now, you know, the exhibitions we're working on are we host 6 exhibitions a year here, and then 2 in Tokyo at our satellite museum at Snoopy Museum Tokyo, which I also curate. So
wow.
So I'm curating 8 exhibitions a year.
Wow, that's a lot.
And they're all kind of in various stages of development. And because of the physical space, they all kind of have a similar format, if you will. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one gallery is only original strips. That's it. There's no reproductions. It is, you only see originals in this space. And there's like 50, there's like room for about 50. 55-ish, depending on the you know, ratio of Sundays and dailies. So that has a very different, you know, mold that has to fit in, rather than like my big gallery, which only fits, you know, maybe like 25 to 30 strips. So it's fewer strips, but I can have a lot more fun with it. I can do reproductions. We can show, I can show anything in that space.
Right. So it's
wide open but it takes a different kind of development. So yeah, these are all kind of doing that bit. And so depending on what we need to do in each of these, because of their content, you know, maybe one's like I'm working on one. It's going to be the small gallery, which is really fun because we get really deep into a, you know, niche stuff. And yeah, it's going to be the Poppet theater strips, the Sundays that are Snoopy doing his Poppet theater.
Yeah.
And which is a lot of fun. Because, I mean, Schultz did like, I can't remember the number now. It's like 12 or 15 of them over the course of like 20 years. So it was like this very slow running gag.
Right.
It's a jogging gag. And so he made a lot of like film references, which he loved movies.
I love the Jaws one.
Yeah, that's one of my very favorites. Yeah. That one requires some, like, I'm going to borrow some cool stuff from a Orson Welles collection at the University of Michigan. So, you know, we've got to coordinate with those people and figure that all out, the logistics behind that. And, you know, so we don't always borrow stuff for those exhibitions, but it just adds an extra layer of complication. And so, yeah, a normal day is filled with a lot of variables.
Right. And you're lending a lot of things of your own to outside, yes, collections and shows as well, right?
That's right. So
the Billy Ireland Museum, I saw, you know, was doing a really nice Schultz exhibit, and I'm guessing some of that came from your archives.
Yes, we don't lend a ton of stuff out, but we will sometimes. So like the Billy Ireland, it's a great example because we borrow things from them. That was actually part of a big swap we did. I did an exhibition on the cartoonists that influenced Schultz as a kid, and so they had a lot of originals there that I was able to borrow.
And this is in Columbus, Ohio. I don't know if that exhibit is still going, but
the Schultz one, I think it's closed now.
Okay.
So there's 17,897 peanut strips, right? Mm-hmm. How many of those originals are still in possession of the museum?
Just under 8,000.
And the rest are scattered to the wind in private hands, God knows where.
Yeah, there's a few collections here and there. The Billy Ireland's a great, you know, they have a handful. Library of Congress has a few. The federal government has a few in some various collections. I'm trying to find, apparently J. Edgar Hoover had one. I'm trying to find.
Are you serious? Was that a gift?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you just kind of, I don't know. So yeah, they're all over the place. Some have been destroyed. We know about some. We know there was an exhibition at the University of Minnesota, like in the 50s, of originals, wow, and like a dozen were stolen. And so like we don't know where any of those. I think we know where one is in our collection when we found the story about them being stolen. So we know one went back out into the world and came back to us somehow. But yeah, the others are just, you know, we have no idea where they are.
Now, do you guys actively look for them out there, like to,
yes,
bring them back home? Mm-hmm.
Yes, we do. So
is there a Holy Grail missing strip? Like, is, well, the first one around?
Yeah, no, the first one would probably be it. I mean, the very first, you know, October 2, 1950 is unknown.
Oh,
don't know whatever happened to it. Because, you know, some we know, like, there's a pretty good number where we have like the letter from UFS, you know, it's like, oh, Senator so-and-so's mother has asked for this, you know, original. Can we send it to her? You know, and that's, it's been sent to them, you know? So it's like, okay, well, that's probably in that family somewhere if it's not been destroyed or whatever. So a bunch we know like that, but you know, the trail has gone cold after like 1960 or whatever.
Sure. So, yeah.
Do you have any recent finds that you're really excited about?
Oh my God. Yes. What can I talk about? So in March, coming up, I'm going to do a big exhibition on kite flying and the kite eating tree.
Nice.
And I'm pretty excited about, and I get to share with the world an unpublished Sunday, which is probably wow. It's probably one of the first Sundays he ever did. It's a pre-publication Sunday. It's probably from late 1951.
Wow.
And it has a kite gag. So we're gonna display that, and it's a recent acquisition, and I've been dying to share it with the world for however long we've had it. So
that's great.
Yeah.
Have you ever found anything interesting on the back of the original?
Oh yeah,
strip?
Yeah.
A sketch or a start of another strip?
The back's typically not. Typically it'll be just Schultz's return address, ink stamped on them for a certain range of years, like kind of early years or like that. After a while, there's nothing. What he would do if he messed up like a daily, he would sometimes reuse, he'd cut them up and use them for spot illustrations. You know, if he needed cover art for a Holt Reinhardt paperback or something, like he would draw sometimes on those, but that's about it.
Speaking of that, actually, we noticed that he did the psychiatry strip. He did a one-off, and then like over a year passes and it shows up again. But it did show up first, I think, actually, on a book cover. Do you know about that? Like why? Yeah, what was the story about that, if there is one?
This is all like, just supposing. I have a copy. Where is it? I guess I don't have a copy handy. But yeah, the paperback collection was You're Out of Your Mind, Charlie Brown. So he needed a back cover illustration for that. What I imagine happened is he's just thinking of the title and just thinking of what would be funny. And he drew Lucy at her psych booth for the very first time for that back cover illustration.
Wow.
And that preceded the psych booth gag by just like a couple months, but with publication timelines, he definitely would have drawn it earlier. So
right.
So that's what I imagine happened, is he was just thinking about the title and just what would be a funny, little drawing for that, and just came up with it. So
I have a really specific question, and I don't know if you can answer it or not, but it's been in the back of my mind for about, 5 years or so. So, I worked on the revival of Mystery Science Theater 3000, and that's based out of the Minneapolis, St. Paul area, just as Peanuts is. So it's weird that I've done two things that are so, Minnesota so focused.
Yeah.
But in the process of that, I met a lawyer, a guy named Ken Abdo, who said he lived in Charles Schultz's house. And he said, We knew the story behind this. We found that there was this original mural that Schultz had done in one of the children's playrooms, or in the children's playroom or nursery or whatever it was, and that he had gone to great lengths to make sure when he sold that house that wall essentially was going with him, and he was trying to get it to the Schultz Museum. And he said, I'm hoping it's going to happen. And I don't know the ending of that story. I don't know if it's something that you can share with us.
I can. Mr. Abdo, the Abdo family owned that house for like two generations.
Was it the second house?
It was their final house in Minneapolis. It was a big house. I think it maybe even was owned at one point, like by a former governor of Minnesota. Like,
okay.
It was a pretty impressive house for 1955 or whenever they bought it. I can't remember off the top of my head, but So Schultz sells that house in 58 to move to California, and it was bought by someone else, and they didn't own it very long. And then they're the ones that sold it to the Abdo family, and the Abdos, like two full generations, owned and lived in that house like forever. Wow. And so Craig Schultz, one of Schultz's sons, had gone back to, Minneapolis to see, what would be his, childhood home, and had told them, this is probably 30 years ago now, hey, if you ever think about selling, let me know. I might be interested in buying the house. Well, the years go on, and they're ready to sell the house, and Craig is really no longer willing to own a house in Minneapolis.
Yeah.
But they do talk about those murals. And so they're two pieces. They're on perpendicular facing walls. One's a running Snoopy, and one is a Charlie Brown in elaborate cowboy garb, including six shooters, waving them in the air, and cactuses behind him. And, you know, it's a very Gunsmoke kind of scene.
So you think it's like probably 1955, maybe, when he did?
Yeah, it would have been between like 55-ish and 58, and probably earlier. So yeah, Craig put together a deal and was able to get those removed. They were, the lath and plaster walls were cut out.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
And shipped here, and then here at the museum. And we've had them for a couple years. It was actually while we were closed during COVID that we were closed to the public for a year, that we were already underway with those two murals. They're like, how big are they? They're 3.5 foot square a piece, maybe. So they're not, I mean, they're big, but not humongous, you know.
Is that the biggest individual pieces of art that we know that Schultz actually drew of a single character, or are there bigger things that he did?
No, there's different. We have some big, like Chalk Talk type sketches, you know,
like bigger than bigger than 3.5 by 3.5, because that is pretty decent size for Schultz. It is. I mean, when I think of Schultz, yeah, I think of little panels in a comic strip.
They're probably about the same size. Mm-hmm. But yeah, they're probably up there with the biggest we know. They're probably among the biggest and most finished. Yeah, for sure. So yeah, we had those conserved and preserved and installed here at the museum, so you can actually see those Minneapolis. They are now on display.
Oh, so I've got to find a way to get out there and see that. That sounds so fun.
Yeah, so we might have them. We might have pictures on the museum website. So I'd have to go look.
That's great. Well, thank you for sharing that.
Yeah,
tell us about your book. I think it's such a clever and it's a perfect way for a museum curator to write someone's biography, I think, you know, by curating all these objects. And where did that idea come from, and what was the process like, and how'd you work with Nat Gertler, who's a noted world famous Peanuts historian?
Yeah. So we had been talking for a while about, you know, some kind of evergreen museum catalog keepsake book kind of thing for our gift shop. It was just kind of an idea. And it's like, well, that would be nice if we ever have, you know, the time, you know, it's kind of one of those things. And then as we were talking about Sparky Centennial and, you know, what we could do that was kind of a special project. And, you know, I thought about all the big anniversary books that he would do for Peanuts. You know, there's some really wonderful collections he would do at some of those big anniversary years.
Yeah.
Of the strips. And I thought, well, maybe this is the opportunity to do that museum book. And so I thought, well, you know, if we're going to do that, let's make it 100 objects, you know, 100 objects for 100 years. It's like, we've got far more than 100 objects. So it should be pretty easy. And so, and this was also during COVID. So it's like, okay, I've got a little time, you know, things are all up in the air. We have no idea what's going on. And it's like, I could probably do that. But as we reopened and other things were moving and there's a lot of other stuff going on behind the scenes. And it was like, okay, I need some help. Cause it's so I wrote about some of those objects. I already had, like, you know, pretty complete texts on some of them. Some of them just had kind of bullet points of like dates and, you know, why it was chosen and things like that. And I was like, okay, I could really use a co-writer, but I need somebody who has, you know, who I don't need to educate on Schultz's biography.
Right. Right.
And somebody who can get up to speed really quick and has time to do it. Cause there was, you know, thought about, you know, working with Lex Fajardo, who's
over that guy.
But you know, Lex was, you know, because the timeline on this was extremely, extremely compressed.
Oh, I bet. Yeah.
And so it's like, okay, Lex, I don't think he does not have the time. So I was like, okay, much as he would love to, you know. So it's like, okay, I wonder what Nat Gertler's doing. So we got that figured out. And so I gave Nat all of my notes and, you know, some things that were done and some things that weren't, and kind of, and it was, you know, but all the objects were selected, kind of what the point of all of them were selected. Nat did help pick out a couple like supporting kind of images and things too, and which was helpful, including donating an object too. We were able to find the first appearance of Peanuts on the cover of a magazine. Huh. And we didn't have a copy, but Nat did in his collection. So he donated it to the museum and we included it in the book. So,
well, Nat must have been a kid in a candy store working with.
Yeah. All so, yeah, he got it done. He got his part done really quick. So I think he had a good time.
So what the 100 objects, what was the process like going through, you know, the whole museum and saying, are these are the 100 things that, you know, reflect this guy's life?
Right. Well, you know, I've been, you know, working with it, you know, his life and telling the story through objects for, you know, a while. And so there, you know, I said, okay, 100 objects is the framework. I don't know how many, but probably the majority of the 100, you know, it was just, I couldn't write it down fast enough. You know, it's like, it's going to be this, it's going to be that, it's going to be this, it's going to be that. Because there's some things that are just really obvious. Mm-hmm. But as we looked it over and started saying, okay, like, how do we divide it into sections? Like, how do we make this a book and not a museum exhibition?
Right.
And so I was like, okay, so it kind of needs to be divided up a little differently. And okay, what are, you know, we want to make this. Another thing that was important to me was like, we want to tell the story of the whole man. You know, it's not,
right.
It's not just about Peanuts. It's about this guy. So, you know, I wanted to be sure we touched on things that were important to him personally that really had almost no connection at all to Peanuts. So, and also some things that were like, okay, you know, Sparky was such a generous man, you know, as well. He means so much in this community. You know, how do you show an object for philanthropy? You know, how do you do that? So it's
something he doesn't have anymore.
Right.
Yeah. Blank page.
Yeah. Here's his empty checkbook. So, and also be interesting to look at, which was also important to us, that it had to be a beautiful book and it had to be interesting to look at. And so some of these objects have appeared in other books, but we have, you know, new photography for all of it and you get to see it in a little different way and that kind of thing. So, yeah.
Well, very cool. It's really so having spent so much time, you know, immersed in this world, do you have any what are some misconceptions people have about Peanuts or about Schultz himself that you think?
Oh, gosh, I don't think any of your listeners would have these misconceptions. So, you know, it's that it's for kids. Right. It's, you know, because it's definitely not. I mean, kids enjoy it, but I have a 7-year-old. I mean, he had a Peanuts book at dinner last night and he was laughing his head off the whole time, including that shark strip with Puppet Theater.
Nice.
He doesn't even know what Jaws is, you know. Look at that shark. Ha ha ha. You know,
hey, but he is a young man of discerning taste. That's right. All that matters.
That's right. I'm raising him right. So yeah. Other misconceptions. Let's see. Gosh, I'm not even sure now.
How about little known facts or something you wish people knew more about Schultz? Is there anything that you can would come to mind?
Little known facts. I mean, just how generous he was. I mean, there's so many stories from cartoonists, you know, both people who've become very successful in their own right, but also, you know, I've talked to cartoonists who are like, oh, I always wanted to be a cartoonist and I drew for my school paper. And in 1984, I drove up to Santa Rosa from somewhere else in the Bay Area and Schultz sat down with me for an hour and we talked cartoons. And it's like, and I went home and I still draw a cartoon for a, you know, a professional newsletter that, you know, goes to 38 people and that's it, you know?
Right.
It's like Schultz was so generous with his time, like especially with anybody who was an aspiring cartoonist. You know, he was just generous in a lot of ways. And I think people know that who met him and knew him, but I don't think of just, you know, day-to-day fans would know that.
Right. Well, that's great. That's great to know. And we've certainly seen it in the letters that have popped up from Schultz and so many stories among cartoonists. I had told this story, I think more than once here, about when Schultz was ill and a friend of mine had this gigantic piece of poster board he turned into a get well card for Sparky. I went to, I think it was Mid-OhioCon. This was probably 1999. And went around and just asking people if they wanted to sign a get well card to Charles Schultz. And every single person, it didn't matter if they were an artist, it was Don Wells of Gilligan's Island, it was Lou Ferrigno, anybody who was at that convention, when you mentioned Charles Schultz in a get well card, everybody wanted to sign it. It didn't matter if they were making the craziest, darkest, you know, uber superhero comic, or if they were, you know, doing a fantasy thing, or if they were doing straight humor. It didn't matter. It was like he covered the whole spectrum. He touched everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, we we're still turning stuff up in the archives, you know, where it's just like, oh, here's a Christmas card from Doris Day, you know, you know, Doris Day.
Wow.
You know, there was a strip, you know, that we, it was an original strip to Vincent Price, you know, thanks, Charles Schultz. He's like, you know, how do you meet Vincent Price? And there's no letters. Right. Nobody can tell me. It's just like, okay, well, sure. You know, it's like, why not?
Every time I see a letter he wrote to someone or he sends a sketch to someone or whatever, I think back when I was in fourth grade, we had to write a letter to a celebrity to like learn. And my two choices were Charles Schultz or Willie Stargell, first baseman for the Pittsburgh Pirates. I went with Willie and Willie didn't write back.
Yeah.
And I see I'm like, no.
Yep. I know. I wish I would have written him.
And I was not going to be a first baseman. You know, there was right to that.
Yeah.
Well, Benjamin, I wanted to ask you that. So you are curator for the Charles M. Schultz Museum and Research Center. Now, for all of us Peanuts nerds, mm-hmm. What is the Research Center part of this? And what can people do who are really into Peanuts at this space?
So, the Research Center is just part of the museum. It's our archives.
Mm-hmm.
So I oversee the archives as well. So I oversee the collections here. So all the original art, Schultz's original, you know, like his personal effects, you know, that kind of stuff. And that's kind of one team of people and philosophy of, you know, how we do things. And then the archives are all the paper, audiovisual, photographs, you know, video materials, you know, all that stuff. And that's another staff of people and another philosophy of how we do things. So they're similar but separate.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to do research on Peanuts or Charles Schultz's life or whatever, you have a specific question and you'd like to come see if our archives can answer that through, you know, with your own research, you're welcome to do that. You have to, you know, make arrangements ahead of time. You can't just show up and say, I want to see, you know, Schultz's correspondence with UFS from 1957, you know, mm-hmm. it doesn't work like that. We can't just do that, but I'm very proud actually of how responsive we are via email compared to, you know, most other archives in the world. So
Benjamin, if somebody did get in touch with you in advance and they said, okay, I'm coming to Santa Rosa, I'll be in the area for a few days. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking into trying to understand this and this about Schultz. Obviously, you guys have a lot of things to do.
Yeah.
But what does that look like for the researcher? Do they have to have certain credentials? Do they have to have a specific end in mind that would be public, you know, sharing to the public? How does that work?
Yes, it would. All of that is helpful to know. We would want to know all of that ahead of time. Yes. Mm-hmm. But you don't need to be a professor at Ohio State University, you know, to do that. You know, it's, you can just, you know, be yourselves on your podcast and you just mm-hmm. want to, you know, look at something that's, you know, pertinent to something you're interested in or whatever. I mean, you know, we had someone here not too long ago, they wanted to look at, and we can do this too, if you make arrangements, we can't do it for everybody. It kind of depends on what it's for, but you know, someone who's working on a publication who wanted to see originals from the late 90s of Schultz with Rain, original strips with Rain.
Oh, wow.
And so we were able to, you know, make that happen. And that's somebody who's working on something for a, you know, national publication. So that's, you know, we're able to do that.
That's great.
So yeah, it's going to be cool when it comes out. So
yeah, Benjamin, yeah, you mentioned the museum in Tokyo.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you knew of any other institutions around the world dedicated to Schultz or Peanuts.
I don't think there are any others. No, Snoopy Museum Tokyo is our only satellite museum. So
no unofficial things?
Nothing unofficial, no.
Except somebody's spare bedroom, right?
Yeah.
There's probably lots of those shrines. And
there may be lots of shrines out there. Yeah. there are some LBEs, you know, location-based entertainment kind of installations around the world, where you can go in and it's mostly like photo op kind of stuff where you can go in and take pictures with statues of the characters and you might see some, you know, really cool spaces and things, but it's not really like a deep historical experience. So
how would you describe Japan's relationship with Peanuts? Cause I mean, the things I see design wise that come out of Japan that have to do with Peanuts blow me away. And I'm wondering, is it generally the iconography of Peanuts that they're relating to, or are the actual strips themselves or the animated specials? What is it that you see? It's different of say a general Japanese audience for Peanuts versus say American audience.
Yeah, so you're right. It is its own very special relationship. It's Japan was the first country outside the U.S. that Peanuts appeared in newspapers.
And, really?
Wow.
And it was, oh gosh, the date on that is early, like 51.
And, you know? Translated into Japanese?
It was not translated. It was in English.
Okay.
But when Peanuts was translated into Japanese, it was done by... his name escapes me, but he was the poet laureate of Japan.
Oh my gosh.
And he did, from what I understand from, you know, bilingual people, he did such a beautiful job and he did the entire thing, I understand. So,
oh, wow.
So I have met fans in Japan who are kind of surprised that Peanuts is American.
Wow.
Because it reads and it feels native to them and it feels, you know, very close to them. So it's, and you're right. The various licensees and people who work with Peanuts in Japan produce some beautiful stuff. And I love what the team at Snoopy Museum Tokyo do with their exhibitions. Cause it's a completely different take than what we do here, but it's still just beautiful and compelling and fun. And, so I love working with them too.
Hey, and shout out to our Japanese listeners. We actually chart on the visual arts chart in Japan.
Oh, I believe it. Yeah.
because of Schultz, obviously, not because of our charms. Yeah. So, but we're so grateful that they listen. We could do this for the next 5 hours. So, but how about we take a break right now and then we come back and we get into discussing your pick, your big five strips that you're going to discuss.
Oh yeah. Okay. Sounds good.
All right. We'll see you on the other side, people.
Hi, everyone. I just want to take a moment to remind you that all three hosts are cartoonists themselves, and their work is available for sale. You can find links to purchase books by Jimmy, Harold, and Michael on our website. You can also support the show on Patreon or buy us a mud pie. Check out the store link on unpackingpeanuts.com.
And we're back. Did you miss us? I missed you. So, okay. Benjamin, we gave you the impossible task of selecting five strips to talk about of the 17,897. What was that process like for you? What, did you have them right at the top? Or?
Oh, no. I begged. I said, I need some restrictions here. I need some guidance. Liz was very kind to say, well, we're going to be talking about 60, 65 or 65, 66 soon. It's like, okay, I'm going to pick from there. So yeah, I did a flip through 65 and 66, and yeah, it was just bing, bang, boom. So
Well, I think it's like the critical period in the strip. And this is just getting into the big transition where the whole world kind of opens up.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we just read a bunch of these, and I wasn't sure when Marcy was going to show up. I mean, Peppermint Patty, and there she is.
Yep.
Peppermint Patty just arrives from the future.
Right.
It's wild. She's just like, hi, I'm a modern person. Here I am, fully formed. Amazing. Well, we have a couple to get to before we get to our pal Peppermint Patty. So let's start with your first pick, which was March 14th, 1965. Charlie Brown is standing outside holding what is evidently the string of his kite, which is, of course, scrawled all across the ground and up into the kite-eating tree. In the next panel, he walks along, cleaning up the messy string, and then finally he arrives at the tree saying, "Now look, tree, that's my kite you've got up there, and I want it back." He's now sort of ranting, low-key ranting at the tree. "I paid 79 cents for that kite. You have no right to take it." Now he's full on ranting. "You can't go grabbing every kite that flies by, you know. Now give it back, do you hear me?" We then have a silent panel. The tree does not respond. And Charlie Brown just sighs, eyes closed. Then he walks away saying, "You can't argue with a kite-eating tree." Now tell us what about that, Major Pickett?
Well, that is the first naming of the kite-eating tree.
Wow.
Whoa. And this is going in my kite exhibition, because actually the Schultz Museum has the original of this strip of this Sunday.
Cool.
And so this will be on exhibit beginning next March and as part of that exhibition. So it's really cool. You know, when the kite-eating tree's first appearance is in the strip is kind of a matter of debate among fans, because is it the kite, is it the tree in 1954 or whatever that he snags his kite on? Is it the tree that more eats it, you know, later? You know, it's kind of a thing, but the naming we can pinpoint. It's this is it. So
is the tree drawn consistently?
No.
It's very distinctive. So it's always different.
So yeah, looking at the kite eating tree for this exhibition, I realized that kite-eating tree is a type of tree. It's not a specific tree in his neighborhood. It's more like a species of tree or something. So, and actually something else with this, we were looking at, when I'm planning exhibitions and I've kind of got a lot of the stuff, you know, I've got a rough framework and I have most of the art picked out and what we're going to do. I share it with a committee of people, including, you know, Gene Schultz and some others to get some feedback. And one of those people is Rosie McDaniel, who's the widow of Mark Cohen, who a lot of old time cartooning folks will know.
Oh, yeah, of course.
So Jeannie says Rosie and Mark were their social secretaries. They were the ones that would line up all the meetups and stuff with cartoonists, because Sparky was just not, you know, social enough to do that. So anyway, Rosie's in these meetings, too. And she's a lot of fun. And as we're sitting there, looking at this strip blown up on a huge screen in the original, she suddenly almost jumps out of her chair.
I think I know where this is going.
And she says, "Do you see that?" I see what?
Panel
she
two. Said,
look at the throwaway panel up there by, you know, next to the title panel. Look at the string on the ground.
Yeah.
It's, if you look, it says Elm.
Elm, yeah.
E-L-M.
Oh, wow. I was just going to bring that up. Yeah. And I was like, is this our clue from Sparky of what kind of tree this
mind tree is? Mind blown.
So it's like this little Easter egg. It's like, is it deliberate? It's like, it must be, you know.
It's got to be.
And it's, you know, I asked Paige Braddock and Lex over at the studios, like, what do you guys think? You know, is this for real, like deliberate or what, you know? And they're like, yeah, it must be. It's like, wow.
Because if you were just cartooning a curled string, I think you would continue the curls in the same, you know, right? It would be like a penmanship exercise. But he deliberately reverses the curve coming out of what looks like the L loop.
yes.
to make that M. It's got to be intentional. That's so wild.
So now I'm looking at all the string on the ground and every string on the ground. It's like, did he do any other, you know, Easter eggs for us? And
that's amazing. You know, and the last panel obviously confirms your theory, because it's not, you can't argue with the kite eating tree. It's you can't argue with a kite eating tree.
Yeah.
So yeah.
It's
wow.
So yeah. And he also, you know, he didn't draw it really consistently either. I mean, this tree in particular does, you know, this more or less, this tree shows up quite a lot, but there are some very, very different trees that are also kite eating trees. So
can you tell us, for people who haven't had the experience of looking at the original art, what is the difference when you get to experience looking at that original versus what we're looking at now, which is just a reproduction on a screen or a book?
In the original, there's so much more subtlety, the weight of the line. Sometimes you can even see the motion of it, and they're just big, you know. Gosh, dailies are, you know, 20, 22-ish inches long and 6 inches high. You know, and Sundays are, you know, even bigger. You know? Yeah, right. And so, I mean, they're huge. And when you're only used to ever seeing them in the newspaper, you know, one of those daily, you know, how the dailies show up in the newspaper would fit in one panel, you know,
right.
You know, in length. So there's just so much more richness seeing them in the original. You get all these little subtleties, and Schultz was just a virtuoso penman. I mean, he could, mm-hmm. You can look at, especially in the original, you know, he talks about how when he was drawing Snoopy's doghouse, and he's drawing the slats of wood. Mm-hmm. He's like, I would think wood.
Yeah.
And it would look like, and you know, the way he could pull and just let that ink flow, just that, you know, immeasurable tiny amount yes. down, it was just enough to achieve something that your brain says would when it right. looks at it. And he could do that with between, like, you're looking at a line of ink both times, but your brain says wood, metal.
Yeah.
You know, whatever.
Grass.
Yeah. And you just, you can do, he was able to do that. And it's just like, oh my God,
this might be an unanswerable question, but do you have any idea when he switched to that Radio 914 pen nib that he did for, he used for decades?
I do know.
Hang on. Wait, I got to savor it. All okay. right, go ahead.
In my new book, you can read all about it.
Fantastic.
I'm pretty sure we have to have told that story. So the Radio 914 pen nib is not a drawing pen nib.
Right.
It was kind of a slightly fancier version of a pen nib designed for basically keeping ledgers at a bank. Estabrook had a near clone. It's called like the Bank 1-4 or something like that. So it was, this one is just plated. Then the Radio 91, the radio part is just a plated nib. So it cleans a little easier, and that's about it. So at Art Instruction back in, you know, this would have been early days, probably, you know, late 40s. You know, he's hired by them in 46. You know, he's back from the war and he works there for, you know, a few years. So, you know, sometime in 46, 47, don't know exactly when, but it's in that range of time. He has to sign, because when you would graduate from Art Instruction Correspondence School, you got this great, big, beautiful diploma. And it was signed by all the instructors. And, well, not all of them, but, you know, a lot of the instructors would sign them. Anyway, one day he was given a stack of these diplomas that he had to sign. And whoever dropped them off also gave him some pen nibs to use to sign with. And they dropped off these Radio 914 pen nibs, because they're just workaday.
Yeah.
you know, a very fine point so you can squeeze a bunch of signatures on, you know, on this diploma or on this stack of diplomas and that he was supposed to sign. And as he's signing these diplomas with this pen nib, which was unfamiliar to him at that point beyond like, oh, that's just something you would use. You know, it's not like a fine drawing instrument. And he's signing away and he's like, hey, I like this. Mm-hmm. Wow. I can really get a nice line on that. I can get, wow. So as he's doing that, that is when he discovers the Radio 914.
Wow.
Is signing his name innumerable times on correspondence school diplomas. And that was it. So that was what he would use until, you know, we don't really know exactly when this happened, but he like reorders some or, you know, a gross of them or whatever. And somebody lets him know, hey, by the way, Esterbrook has quit making these. And, you know, you're just, you know, they still have, you know, quite a stockpile, but, you know, they don't make them anymore. And at that point, Esterbrook had gone into just only making fountain pens instead of dip pens. Mm-hmm. And I think they maybe even were going out of business and, you know, some other things were going on. So I don't know exactly when that happened, but at some point, Sparky found out that they were no longer making them. And so he gets in touch with Esterbrook and buys all of them. Right? He buys the rest. He does his calculations and he figures out, okay, this quantity will last me the rest of my life. It should.
Gee.
And it does.
Wow.
When he dies at the age of, you know, 77, he has, like, I think we had like three boxes left.
Wow.
Wow.
Well, so Benjamin, I wanted to ask you though, is it your understanding that he's using that at the beginning of Peanuts? Because my theory was when I look at the line, it's so different in like the blow up that you have behind you, the very first panel of Peanuts, that he's using something different. And my theory was when he started to do the Young Pillars strips, he was working very fast and loose with that, with these teenage characters. And I thought maybe that's when he said, hey, I'm going to use the Radio 914 for that. And then he at some was that would have been like what 1956 or something. Maybe that was when Schultz then said, hey, I could maybe transition to the strip with that.
No, he's using the Radio 914, but he's using other nibs too. I mean, he's not using.
So you think in 1950 he was using that 914?
Yeah. Yeah.
One of the things I find interesting about it is that it is that writing penmanship pen. I got to do a story for that 65th anniversary book that Boom Studios put out a few years ago. So I went online, and if you go online you could find like vintage stationery places and stuff, and I got a bunch of them and I was trying to get them to work and I couldn't get it to do anything. And I could use a dip pen, you know, I used to ink with a Hunt 102. And so I was reading up on it, you know, his interviews, and I read, oh, it's a writing pen. And I thought, well, I'll just try to write. Like if I'm right. And it's like, oh man. And then suddenly it's like magic happens. And you're like, that's that line. Now you can't draw as well as Schultz, so it's never going to be that. But right. That one moment of making it happen for just, it was like, oh, I've arrived at Valhalla. That's it. That's that's being a cartoonist, buddy.
Yep. Yeah. I've heard Mo Willems tell a similar story, you know, about trying to, he did a whole book with oh, wow. Radio 914. He did one of his Naked Mole Rat books. And cool. With, I think it was Naked Mole Rat Gets Dressed with the Radio 914. And it was, and he just, yeah, it's just such a struggle.
Yeah, it really, really is. The fact that he looked at it and was like, but I guess because he started right signing his name. Because it's a lot of the fussy stuff that you have to use with a regular dip pen isn't really present in this pen. And when you try to make it like the Hunt one, it doesn't do anything. It like maybe you'll smudge a little or scratch it a little bit. But when you just put it up and just start being very free with it, it's cool. It's really cool. Mm-hmm. Their G nib out there for you fans is the closest thing. It's like a manga nib. That's like, but it's not. It's not the same thing. But.
Yeah. Yeah. You can still find them online and they can be kind of expensive because pen nib collectors, you know what I mean? Everybody knows it's the Schultz nib. So,
right.
Yeah. But you can get the clone, just the regular 1-4, which is, it's identical, except it's just not plated the same. That's the only difference. I understand.
Oh, that is good to know. All right. June 5th, 1965. Charlie Brown, wearing a little sailor's cap, is sitting on a bus. He says to no one in particular, "Well, here I am on a bus going to camp. These camp buses are pretty nice, I guess." Leans his head in his hands and says, "Sigh, we've only been on this bus for 10 minutes and already I'm lonesome." In panel four, he looks forlorn and he says, "I feel like I'm being drafted."
So this one I picked because this is a very emotionally autobiographical strip. Yeah. You know, Schultz never went to summer camp, ever. So a lot of these summer camp strips are actually pretty reflective of his experience in the Army during World War II.
Right.
And this one's the most, you know, it's one of the most kind of directly obvious, you know, because he was drafted in January of 43. Yeah, just after his 20th birthday. So, yeah. And went to Fort Campbell. And of course, while he's doing his induction at Fort Snelling there, just across the river from where he lived in St. Paul, his mother had passed away. You know, she was pretty ill with cancer for several years. And, you know, he had never been away from home, hardly. He'd never been away from his parents. And here his mother has died and he's off to war. So, you know, Schultz said kind of famously once that, you know, he learned everything he ever knew about loneliness while he was in the Army. And, and it makes sense. You know, there was one of his biographers tracked down the guy Schultz sat next to on the train from Fort Snelling down to Fort Campbell.
Wow.
And, you know, it was like, I can't remember the guy's name, but, you know, it's alphabetically right next to Schultz, you know?
Right.
And he said, yeah, he said, we were on that train for 3 days and he didn't say a word, you know?
Oh my gosh.
Oh, wow.
And he said, you know, he just stared out the window and he said, I found out later his mom had just died. I was like, yeah, that would do it. So,
wow. Well, that last panel in this strip you picked.
Yeah.
Charlie Brown is kind of sunk down in his seat. You're looking at him through the window of the bus and he just captures this terrible, terrible feeling.
Yeah.
In that last panel.
And, you know, Schultz was, he carried those emotions, even those, like, you know, those old emotions, those old feelings, he could pull that up.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have personally, you know, I have a really hard time, you know, like, I kind of remember how I felt, you know, at certain moments in my life, but, you know, I can't make myself still feel that same emotion necessarily, you know, thinking back about, you know, something like that. And the thing was, he could do that. Not even just about these big feelings, like, you know, his mother just dying and going off to the Army. You know, that's a big one, but he could do that all the time. And that was just something in his nature, just the way he was made, that he could do that. And he did that in Peanuts. You know, he could recall those emotions and feel those emotions and pour it into his drawing.
Yeah, just like drawing wood, he's feeling that when the pen is going down on the paper.
Absolutely. I mean, just look at the subtle differences between Charlie Brown's eyes in the second, the third and fourth panel. I mean, the eyes themselves, the two dots. I mean, those two dots go from, you know, just like a 1,000-yard stare in panel three to this bleak, you know, forlorn look in panel four. And it's like, they are still just two dots.
Right. They are maybe one half of a millimeter more of an oval than a circle. Yes. And then they have parentheses.
Exactly.
And that signals despair.
Exactly.
So it's amazing.
And we don't even need those half circles.
No.
You know,
no, but that just takes it to that next level of this is existential dread, you know?
Exactly. That helps us read it in, you know, a postage stamp square printed on newsprint. You know, that's, but seeing, you know, like I said, you see that in the original, it breaks your heart. You know, it's just,
oh yeah,
that's the difference.
You know, I'm going to go on record and say it. He was pretty good.
He was pretty good. Yeah, Sparky Schultz knew what he was doing.
He was all right.
Yep.
Yeah. And we were talking, Jimmy, about that you yourself as a cartoonist, you said you remember what it was like to be 10. You got that same kind of memory of things that you were able to capture in your own cartooning. And I think that makes a huge difference in what someone can do in storytelling.
Well, not having anything to do with my work. I mean, you know, I can't speak to that. But I think the most important thing in writing is empathy. Right. Yeah. And the way to express empathy is you might not know that person's specific situations, but you know sadness.
Yeah.
You know fear, you know joy. And you just can't look at the other people in the world as other than you. There and right. That's and it's easy to say that on a podcast. It's hard to do it over 50 years every day in a comic strip. But I think at the core of it, that is what it is.
Yeah, when you see Schultz drawing each of these characters, you don't usually. There's a few exceptions. You don't think other.
No. This little drawing of Charlie Brown. It is a kid going to summer camp that doesn't want to go. It is a young man being drafted. It's a little black kid being bused to a different school. Like, it's all of those things in this one little drawing of this round-headed kid. It's amazing. Amazing. Yeah. July 12th, 1965. This is a familiar one. Snoopy is dragging what looks like a little suitcase behind him. Then he's pushing it. Then finally, in panel 3, he opens it. We can't quite see what it is, but then in panel 4, he is up on top of his doghouse, and we see it was just a typewriter case, and he is typing the words of his first story. It was a dark and stormy night.
Snoopy, as the world-famous writer, is probably my favorite persona.
Oh, nice. We always want to know what the persona. Michael's favorite is Vulture. My favorite is the grocery clerk. And Harold, I don't know yours. What do you have a favorite?
I do love the grocery clerk. That's and I love him as the Poppet Theater. And I also have a real soft spot for Joe Cool.
Joe Cool's great.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you like the writer. The writer's your guy, though?
The writer's my guy. I love the terrible puns and, the jokes that Schultz wants to do but can't do in Peanuts. So he gives the gag to Snoopy to do in his writing. And I think that's hilarious. I mean, it's also really resourceful,
It's having your cake and eating it, too, right? I have this corny joke. If I leave it by itself, it's just a corny joke. But if I have this level of remove, it's Snoopy typing it, suddenly it becomes genius.
It rises above the dad joke.
Exactly.
When he's typing. And again, talk about classic drawings on panel 4.
Yeah.
You've got Snoopy with this kind of this half eye, the half open eye, as if it looks like the picture you would see on the back or on the jacket flap by some author.
Yes.
And how he drops the nose. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that does, but it kind of gives him this air of haughtiness that I think is just classic author image.
Yeah. This is the first dark and stormy night. It's the first time he's on top of his doghouse with the typewriter, all that.
Now, do you know where dark and stormy night came from with Schultz? Like it has appeared, right? It was like a famous bad line of some old thing. And then it's also like Wrinkle in Time and stuff. So where did Schultz come through with that?
We don't know exactly where. I mean, it must have been Bulwer Lytton, but who knows? Who knows?
right. But it's so funny because this really kind of transcends all of them now.
Absolutely. Yeah. And also I love this because I'm so proud of how he drew this typewriter because it looks great.
Yes.
And we have a letter from him during the war, and he's writing to, I think he was writing to his mom passes away. And then his dad, his dad's home alone for the first time, Carl is gone from, a father with a wife and son to just being by himself with the dog Spike. And that's it. Yeah. And so, he eventually, develops a relationship with a woman in the neighborhood who was kind of a family friend of some of his relatives and stuff named Annabelle. And Annabelle starts writing to Sparky while he's away at war. Cause I think he must have known her, like at least like an acquaintance or something. And now his dad's kind of seeing her. And so they start writing to each other. Well, he writes probably for the first time using a typewriter on one of those letters. And he's like, "Hey, I'm using a typewriter. Check it out. Boy, it's taken me a long time to type this, And he draws a little doodle of himself typing on the typewriter at the bottom of the letter. And it is almost unidentifiable as a typewriter. A terrible picture of a typewriter.
That's amazing.
And it's like, I think that's supposed to be a typewriter. It's either a typewriter or he's jamming his fingers into a toaster. And so, it's like, so anyway, so looking at this, I'm like, he got it. He finally could draw a typewriter.
Yeah. So is this a Smith Corona or Remington?
It must be. Theories? Yeah. He's probably whatever was in the office with him. Yeah.
Well, what's so funny to hear that is one of the joys for me reading these now in order is every once in a while, you see, he has the perfect, absolutely minimal drawing of some weird thing that no one's ever drawn before. We've had like a bottle warmer, right? Incinerator, this great cartoon typewriter. He just knows how to do it. Like who first time ever in history draws a bottle warmer and it's four lines and it's perfect and it's identifiable as that.
And we now know the secret. He just thinks bottle warmer while he's drawing it.
He thinks his way into it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he would, you know, one of his instructors back when he was taking the correspondence school was a cartoonist named Frank Wing. Who's a real old timey, you know, nostalgia kind of guy, you know, kind of good old days type panel cartoon guy, and kind of in that Clare Briggs, you know, mode, if you're not familiar
with Webster kind of.
There's a lot of great cartoonists in that kind of genre, I guess, but Frank Wing always said, you know, you have to learn how to draw things realistically before you can cartoon them. Yeah. And he says, you know, you just practice drawing everything. Just draw all the time. And, you know, you need to draw a shoe, take off your shoe and draw it, you know. That really sunk in with Sparky. And he actually ended up sitting next to Frank Wing, his former instructor, when he joined the staff at Art Instruction. And Frank Wing was the one who saw his little drawings of kids he was sending off to the Saturday Evening Post. And he's like, Sparky, you should keep drawing these. They're pretty good.
Amazing.
So yeah, that was kind of his thing was like, okay, I need to draw it realistically first, and then I can figure out how to cartoon it. Because he said he was always doing that when he was, you know, he was just having a conversation with somebody. He's looking at the crease of their collar and the way.
I was just going to bring that up.
That folds.
I remember him reading an interview where he's talking. I think he was talking about Frank Wing, talking about sketching and exactly what you're saying. Yeah. And then he developed this process where he called it like mental sketching, where he would look at you and figure out how the collar would be drawn and all this stuff. And I remember thinking like, oh, Mr. Schultz, you have OCD, but please don't have anyone tell you that. Because as long as you don't know that, you're just going to continue to be a genius.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it was just, you know, it was how he interpreted the world around him. You know, he was, you know, as a little kid, you know, there's stories about him just constantly drawing and drawing on anything he could get a hold of, you know, using the cardboard inserts that the laundry would send his dad's shirts home with, you know, and things like that. Like he would just draw, you know, it was like, oh boy, this is the best stuff I have, you know, it's just these.
Yeah.
You know, just all that stuff figuring out along the way. But when he finally was taught, he just soaked it up because he's like, oh, finally. Okay. Now I understand what I'm doing. And there are several little, you know, kind of eureka moments in his life that we kind of know about and point to. And being taught, like, especially by Frank Wing, is like, oh, okay. I get it. I get it now.
Yeah. There was like no possibility of me being able to take that correspondence course when I was a kid, but I really wanted to. And my neighbor up the street actually did. And she had all the, and I got to see it as like, it's legit. I mean, it's not like you have to put in all the work yourself because you're out on your own. But if you do, it's a legitimate art education. No question about it.
Yeah. Yeah. We've got this. So sometime between his finishing the course as a high schooler and him coming back from the war and being hired. So somewhere in those years, Ernie Bushmiller redid the cartooning.
Oh, really?
Like curriculum. And so Schultz is teaching Bushmiller cartooning in, you know, 51 or not.
Wow.
Like four. No, I'm sorry. Back up like 48, 49 ish. And after he gets the strip, after Schultz gets Peanuts, you know, the Peanuts deal, he writes to Bushmiller at some point just to say, you know, hi, you know, I've loved your work. And also, you know, just let you know, the art instruction people are the boy, they do a great job, and they're really, you know, doing a good job with the materials you gave them and all this stuff. And it's a pretty cool letter. So but it's cool. Incredible to think, wow, imagine being those students in like 1949 or whatever. You're being taught Bushmiller cartooning by Charles Schulz.
That's pretty amazing.
Right. And Bushmiller, just for some of our listeners, he did what strip?
Nancy and Sluggo. Yeah. So yeah, the classic, a classic kid strip. And then they, in those early days when, you know, Schulz is getting some feedback from his syndicate, you know, like, boy, your humor can be pretty subtle and things. And I mean, he kind of went back to them and said, well, you're not getting another Nancy and Sluggo. You know, this is something very right. different. So he knew who he was and
right.
and what he was doing.
Well, he's clearly had tons of confidence.
Yeah.
I mean, from the very beginning, the most minimal gags imaginable and some of those things, it's the spareness of the style. It bespeaks a great deal of confidence to be willing to do that.
Yeah.
And it's self-described as sophistication, which I think is interesting, because I didn't think of the strip as sophisticated, but then once I read that Schulz said that, and that's what he was thinking about the strip. Again, it's not for kids. It's about kids. It does change the way I see these strips now in terms of what he was attempting.
Yeah. I mean, it's an evolution from, you know, the magazine panel style, which is what he was doing, you know, early on. And was a part of his evolution in Genesis, really, is being like, you know, Saturday Evening Post style cartoonist.
Yeah. August 22nd, 1966. It's the first appearance of the legendary Peppermint Patty. She is sitting there next to her pal Roy, who is writing a letter. And she says, "Hi, Roy, who are you writing to?" Roy says, "I'm writing to a little kid named Linus that I met at camp several weeks ago." Patty enthusiastically says, "Is he cute? If he is, tell him your very good friend, Peppermint Patty, says hello. Tell him what a real swinger I am," Patty continues. Then as she walks away, she says, "Put in a good word for me, Roy, and the next time we Indian wrestle, I'll try not to clobber you." This is mind-blowing to me because that's Peppermint Patty.
Boom. Oh, yeah.
Four panels, never seen her before. Here she is, and she's one of the greatest comic strip characters of all time. Already.
Yeah.
I would guess this is the first Peanuts strip without the main characters.
Oh, that's wild. That's true.
Yeah, it might be. Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, that might be. Yeah, Roy is an interesting character too. You know, he shows up mostly at camp and is another army life reference for Schulz. The guy, so he gets to Fort Campbell and he's, you know, kind of in terrible shape emotionally for sure. And this other guy who's a bit older, he's about 10 years older than him, and a cop from St. Louis, and you know, he's been drafted to, and his name is Elmer Hagemeyer. And his middle name happens to be Roy. And Elmer Roy Hagemeyer is the one who kind of takes him under his wing and looks after him. And Schulz would describe it. Yeah. He says he big brothered me. Uh-huh. And he would take Schulz home on, you know, furloughs and stuff. And just, he had this big family and Schulz could just kind of lose himself in that. And they just loved on him and took care of him and fussed over him and was just kind of what he needed, you know? So Roy is obviously, I think, a reference to Elmer Roy Hagemeyer. So I also chose the strip because, yeah, Peppermint Patty, like you said, is fully formed. You know, she's there's no hemming and hawing and what do I do with this character? I mean, it's she's there.
He's the father of what, a 16-year-old at this point, and then down into, you know, younger ages. That's the feeling I get, is that, you know, we know in Sebastopol they had this amazing little compound that Joyce just built out for all of the kids and got was tennis courts and you can shoot a hole of golf or two. And
yeah, four.
This is a place where the kids are attracted to from the friends of all of the Schulz family. And so I can't imagine what he was experiencing through those kids in his own home and, you know, in the surrounding area of his own home. That's what I think of when I think of Peppermint Patty.
Yeah.
He must have been experiencing something that maybe he never had experienced before in Minnesota growing up. This is something new, and like Jimmy is saying, he's capturing something that's going on in the culture with the youth, and Peppermint Patty is this wonderful embodiment in a very unique way. It's not too stereotypical, but she's got this fresh perspective on life that, you know, we certainly haven't seen in Peanuts.
Yeah.
And I don't think we've really seen in comic strips in general. She's just kind of this free spirit, and that she's a swinger.
Yeah.
I mean, well, gosh, wait a second.
Well, one of the things that I was thinking about when preparing for this today, this is 1966. Halfway through 1964 was the release of Harriet the Spy, which is one Louise Fitzhugh, one of my heroes, and that book means a lot to me. And that book, you know, it was shocking because the girl wore sneakers and jeans, right? Among other things. But like, just so this is really fit. This is less than 2 years later, 15, 16 months later. And it's that type of character. And what amazes me is that it's not coming from something that's brand new. Like, this is not like the Peppermint. This is something that's been going on for 16 years. And suddenly he's still able to, like, boom, catch the zeitgeist. He's in the moment. It's that, just the longevity is astounding.
Absolutely. Yeah. And he had Peppermint Patty kind of living in his head for a while before she was ever in the strip. And we don't know exactly how long, but I would guess it was maybe even a couple years.
And, wow.
Because there's a couple hints he drops in some various interviews and things, of, you know, kind of pieced together over time. And he was thinking about, you know, she could maybe be a character who would do like a series of books.
Huh. Wow.
And he readily acknowledges she could carry her own strip
easily.
Yeah.
You know,
and he treats her that way, right? You know?
Yeah.
It's almost like she does have her own strip and stuff.
Oh, really? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's, so yeah, he had the name, you know, picked out, and you know, that there's kind of a well-known story about, you know, she is definitely named after the candies, and although I did figure out it was definitely not York Peppermint Patties.
Oh, it wasn't?
No, because they were not distributed on the West Coast in the mid-60s. So they must have been some other brand. There were quite a few around at the time, so who knows what brand exactly they were, but they were not York. I know that. So,
well, I have told many people it was the York Peppermint Patty. So Liz, cut that part out.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was, but yeah, she, and he said, you know, I had to use the name before Mort Walker did. So
yes, right? Yes.
I love that quote.
And, for aspiring cartoonists out there, please note the use of unnecessary quotation marks around peppermint and hello. Uh-huh. Fantastic. Love it.
And I love in that panel, Roy's slight recoil at her forwardness.
Yeah.
It's just so subtle and so funny.
Yeah.
Well, I love the panel three with her head in her hands, which is a Peanuts pose, but she has a very different look. She's looking up and she's like Luke Skywalker, you know, she's optimism. She's not being forlorn or too contemplative, right? She's all about action.
Oh yeah.
Now, Michael, when you were reading this, what were your thoughts when it was expanding or like with the cast and stuff? Cause you're an original reader, or was this slipping out of your purview?
Yeah, I was familiar with these. I think I was probably paying less attention at this point.
And yeah, because you would have been 16 at this point, right?
Yeah, I was more into buying Marvel comics at that point. I think I might not have been buying the books, which I think were coming out once a year. So yeah. I think I probably stopped that around this time.
Yeah, because it really is the launch of a whole nother wing of Peanuts and a whole nother realm of expression, which is really cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah, going back to that second panel, not only is he recoiling, she is ever so slightly leaning in from, you know, it's great, great cartooning.
Yeah, and Roy's just kind of lifting his arm a little bit and
yeah,
his little shoulder action is yeah, really funny. And Roy's a great design too. I love the kind of the shininess of this curly head of hair.
Yeah. September 19th, 1966. Charlie Brown is laying in bed. It is at night, and he sniffs something's wrong.
I smell smoke, he says, and sniffs again. We cut to panel two. It's outside. Snoopy is very upset, and he's kicking at the door. Bam, 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 bam. Charlie Brown runs outside to see what's going on. We see Snoopy looking off panel right into something which is casting a very bright light. Charlie Brown says, "What in the world?" And then in the last panel, we see Snoopy's doghouse is burning. Charlie Brown is hugging him and says, "Good grief." Snoopy, looking absolutely devastated, thinks to himself, "My books, my records, my pool table, my Van Gogh." And he sobs. So, okay, well, a little history for you, Benjamin, about me. That last panel is the first Peanuts panel I ever saw in my life.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
It was the cover of a book called What's It All About, Charlie Brown. And I saw that and I was like, I got to know what's going on with this thing. This is bizarre.
Yeah, that would do it.
So why would you pick this? I think this whole sequence is amazing.
It's amazing. Yeah, we've got, it's just, yeah, beautifully drawn, of course, and so much going on, the emotions and all this. And it's also actually happened, you know, this is another part of Schultz's life coming into the strip. This was in January of 66. There was a fire at the Coffee Grounds property and his studio burned. And he had gone through a fire before in shortly after he came back from World War II. There was a fire at the building where his dad's barber shop and their apartment was, and they said everything, you know, they lost a lot, you know, in the especially down in the, I guess they had a bunch of stuff stored in the basement of that building, and I think that's when he would have lost his whole, like, he had at one point in time a huge collection of like little big books and comics, all his comics, probably all of his, you know, juvenile drawings.
Any strips and stuff?
No, well, maybe there may have been some of his earliest, you know, tryouts. I know he drew at least one page of a adventure strip that was a French Foreign Legion themed, like a Beau Jest, you know, inspired adventure strip, like a Hal Foster kind of style thing. Mm-hmm. And I know he did a page of that, but I, you know, it's never been seen. Right. Nobody's, you know, it was probably lost. He filled a few notebooks. He said, you know, those like of Sherlock Holmes stories.
Are you serious?
And he shared those with Shermie back when they were like in high school. Mm-hmm. And those are my like personal like holy grail objects. And that, but they were probably lost in that fire.
Didn't he allude to, before he sold Peanuts, that he was sending around to like the Chicago syndicates multiple takes on comic strip ideas? Do you know anything about that? Was he doing like a mixture of you know, comic, comedy strips, adventure strips? Do we know how many different things he might have attempted at that time?
I don't think it was a whole lot. I think there were a few things that he was running with. Yeah. But I don't think he got too far along with those before the kid stuff, you know, started happening, little folks. And I do know there was another kind of kid themed strip that he was circulating called, I think it was called Oh Judy. And there's a kind of a hint of that. There's a character called Judy in one of the Topics Comics pages. He did two pages for Topics Comics as kind of a, he got the opportunity after kind of doing a special job for them and who he's working for lettering. He's lettering for Topics Comics. And he did a special job for them and they let him do a page of just, you know, panel cartoons. And they let him do it twice. And one of them has a kid comic where one of the characters is named Judy. And so it's like, okay, that might have been what Oh Judy was like.
That's what that was.
Yeah. I do have a question. So we know he lost a lot of things from growing up, and we know that he had that big little book collection. He said that he obviously loved comic books. He was kind of the librarian of his community for kids who wanted to get a back issue of a comic book. But he obviously still loved comic books and read them up to a certain point of time. Is there anything in the archives? Did he save comic books? Do we have a sense of when he stopped reading like the popular comics, or did he ever stop reading the comic books of the day?
I think he did pretty early on. I think he was just too busy.
Because we know he did stuff for MAD. He was aware of what was going on with his fellow cartoonists. And
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, he was looking through MAD for sure, especially those years when he's writing back and forth with them. And, you know, he was writing letters for their letters column and stuff. And, you know, but those were just kind of, that's just him, you know, he could dash that off pretty quick.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, he never stops reading the comics in newspapers. Like, he's reading that every day studiously. Mm-hmm. He talks about how he was, you know, he was very competitive, how he wanted to win the page every day. So he's looking at the page and he's like evaluating, okay, what was the funniest? What was clever? You know, who knows what? And what all those criteria were that he's comparing himself to. And so he felt like he had to win the page, you know, as kind of how
I wonder
how
if any other cartoonists were doing that as studiously as Schultz was.
I don't know about that, but I imagine other people are. Yeah, doing something similar.
That's amazing. It's like looking at the sports scores. You know, you're just like, okay, how did I fare this time? Do I pop out? Do I stand out? I did the funniest joke, or did somebody? But yeah, that's so interesting. You know, because that's a side of Schultz that is we know about, but it doesn't often come to the surface of how competitive. You love sports, of course.
Yeah. And it's funny because I always think, you know, people say even like very big media outlets, actually maybe sometimes mostly the big media outlets, when they'd interview them would be like, you must be Charlie Brown, right? And of course, yeah, right. We all are Charlie Brown. But he's also the most successful cartoonist of his time. He's created something that will live on hundreds of years after he. So, you know. He's not really a loser.
Yeah. No. He's all of them for sure. He's all those characters. And yeah, it's remarkable. And he just poured so much of himself into the strip. That's what makes it special, is he is just his ability to translate so much into it. Those experiences, those feelings. So, you know, in January 66, there's another fire. You know, he's already been through a fire and lost, you know, a lot of precious stuff. And he's interviewed by the newspaper in San Bernardino, just like right after the fire, just like a brief little, you know, snippet from him. And he says, yeah, I went in and grabbed my week's worth of strips off the table that were in. So, cause I didn't want to have to redraw them.
Oh my gosh.
And, cause that had happened at that point. He had shipped off like sometime, we don't really know when exactly, but at some point between 58 and 66, is after he moved out to Sebastopol, he had mailed in a week's worth of strips to the syndicate and it never got there.
Oh, wow.
So he had to redraw them from memory. And we don't know what week that is. We don't know. We just know that it happened. Anyway, so that was the first thing on his mind when he sees his studio going up in flames. He's like, oh, I got to get those strips. Because it was in January. And so he said, if I had to redraw them, I wouldn't make the Crosby tournament. go play golf. See, that was like the highlight of his year, was going to go play at the Crosby golf tournament. So,
oh no,
I wouldn't make it. So,
Benjamin, thank you so much for taking this time today to talk to us. It was extraordinary and so special for us. And thank you for your book and for all the work you're doing at the museum. I mean, if there's one cartoonist who deserves this level of scrutiny and attention and preservation, it is Mr. Schultz. So thank you for all your work on that.
Absolutely. Oh, gladly. Thank you. This has been such a thrill to talk to all of you. It's been, it's been awesome. Thank you so much.
So for the rest of you out there, if you want to follow along with the conversation, you can find us at Unpack Peanuts on both Instagram and Twitter. You can visit our website, unpackingpeanuts.com, where you can see what we've picked for the strip of the year. You can check out our store, and you could go to our Patreon, where you could maybe buy us a cup of coffee, go to our store, and maybe buy one of our books, because we're cartoonists too. We're probably not as good as Mr. Schultz, but we do all right. Other than that, thank you for listening. Can't wait to talk to you again next week when we go back into the world of peanuts. Until then, for Michael and Harold, this is Jimmy. Be of good cheer.
Yes.
Be of good cheer.
Unpacking Peanuts is copyright Jimmy Gownley, Michael Cohen, and Harold Buchholz. Produced and edited by Liz Sumner. Music by Michael Cohen. Additional voiceover by Aziza Shakrala Clark. For more from the show, follow Unpack Peanuts on Instagram and Twitter. For more about Jimmy, Michael, and Harold, visit unpackingpeanuts.com. Have a wonderful day, and thanks for listening.
Good grief.